There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Books Boys, live from the Grand Library, the Dean and PJ.
He's PJ.
Hello there.
I'm the Dean, and we are the Books Boys.
The one and only.
This is the Books Boys show. Get it? Buy it? Books.
Books.
I'm joined by little Alfred. There he is.
There he is.
So it's Books Boys, PJ, because there are multiple books and multiple boys. We have two boys and a bear. How many books do we have?
We got a bit more than three. I can tell you that. We got a lot of books.
A lot of books.
What's it all about, Dean? You know, books. How long have we been speaking about books now?
It has been 1 year exactly. It's the 1 year anniversary show.
Oh my God.
Anniversario time.
Wow. Okay. Oh my God. That's crazy, guys. So we've been 1 year to get talking about books. Now, I know it's about paper, but I'm still finding myself going to the, you know, super value. And looking at the toilet paper section and looking for Orwell and having difficulty finding Orwell.
You can't get him there, man. I don't know. It's this kind of thing, right? Scrolls. I've got some papers here that I can write on. Is this books? I don't know.
Yeah, that's newspapers. Look, it's still a mystery, but I hope you're starting to get in a vague platonic idea of what a book might platonically look like.
The platonic form, the perfect book. It exists out there in the realm of platonic beings. You know?
Exactly.
And not only is it our 1 year anniversary episode, it's Halloween. Literally today, we're recording on Halloween.
Spooky.
So everyone, pause the show. No, don't do that. After the show, go and watch some Freddy Krueger, you know?
Spooky. And read some spooky books as well.
Spooky books. I have a really good spooky recommendation later.
And
PJ, I've been inundating you with pictures of my myriad Halloween costumes this year.
Indeed, you have. It's been very exotic. All from what was it again? From the Little Red Riding Hood to.
I was a devil. I was Little Red Riding Hood. I was Antonio Banderas from Desperado.
I like that one. That was good. Yeah, you've been all over the place sending me all these pictures. Good Lord.
And I was posing with a pumpkin in a forest at one point. On a hay bale. I'm a busy man.
Indeed. We're just talking about that Dean has recently joined. He's a very proactive. He'd be very suitable in an Athenian society where they just indulge themselves in all kinds of activities. I believe you've been indulging yourself in the Irish Orwell Society, Dean.
I took some classes. I'm still doing a 10-week course on Orwell. The course is called Orwell in Ireland, but we realized that he didn't really do anything with Ireland, so it's now just become minute details about Orwell's life, you know.
Maybe it's one trip to Dublin explaining great detail. And I believe you've also joined the Ulster University Skiing Society and your painting. So I just imagine reading a book, painting,
everything.
Skiing all over the place, yeah.
Skiing down the slopes whilst painting and reading and making music and everything all at once.
We're reading Orwell specifically and trying to find this Irish connection. I like it.
Yeah, there's not. Well, one of his wives was Irish, but he never talked about it. So having a class about Orwell in Ireland, there's not much to go on.
It's unfortunate.
But man, we're going to talk about some books. Oh, and we should mention briefly, we actually saw each other in person this month.
We did indeed.
Did some Halloween activities.
And the back of your car was literally full of Orwell books. That's the whole
it was.
It was literally full of Orwell books. I didn't know he even wrote that much. So you only wrote like 6 novels. It was 4.
And but altogether, he's got 9 plus stories and essays and a lot. He wrote a lot, actually. But yeah, we saw each other and we took a lot of wacky photos. So they're all going to be up on Instagram soon.
These very, very posing photos, everyone. If you want to see some interesting photos.
Risqué, maybe. Huh?
Yes, indeed. Enfant terrible photos.
Well, let's start. PJ, the first book I read this month. I don't know why. This is not a surprise. It's Orwell.
Oh my God, it's Orwell.
It's Burmese Days. Have you heard of this one even? You might not have.
I've heard of the title, but I don't know what it's about. Is it journalism, or is it a novel?
It's a novel. So a lot of Orwell's novels, some of them are a bit more journalistic. This one is fictional, but it is, you know. So he did have some real Burmese days. You know, like he went over to Burma as a police officer, and so it is kind of, there's some realism in it, but it is a fictional story. This one,
okay.
Essentially, what happens is. Sorry, guys, I know that we got a lot of listeners in England. This is an anti-British Empire book, essentially. So, you know, it's effectively, you know, he's over there and they're all working, and some of them are officers and some of them are just working for private companies. But the attitudes that they have, like towards the locals, like the natives, you know, they treat them like dirt. They insult them. And, you know, it really gives you an idea about the way the British Empire worked. And it's really quite depressing at times, and bits of it can be difficult to read, just with like rampant racism and hatred, to be honest. But he's exposing it, which is good, you know.
Wow. Okay. And yeah. That's his first novel, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's not his very first one, I don't think, but it's an early one. I'm reading them all, but I'm reading them all out of order. It might be his first one, actually. I don't know, but I've read that one, and so I'll give you a bit of an idea of the story. So. There's this chap called Yu Po Kin, and he's a local, but he's managed to get himself a little, not a governorship, but a kind of some kind of position of power amongst the locals. But he's just corrupt. And there's a bit that says the way he does his corruption is he takes a bribe from both sides and then decides the case on purely legal grounds so as to be impartial. But he takes bribes from both sides anyway. So he's just making money left, right, and center. And he's just this big, you know, obese, fat guy who's, you know, just sitting scoffing the food with his hands and raking in money and just corruption and, you know. But there's this doctor called Dr. Vereshwamy, and he really wants to join this club of white people because he believes that they both want to join, but for different reasons. And they believe that this will kind of boost their social standing, you know. So then Yu Po Kin, the official, decides to discredit the doctor in order to get himself recognized by the white people who are running the empire effectively, because all he cares about is not even money, but just like status and fame. And he just wants to like improve his own standing. But all the while he has a wife who's giving him all this, why are you such a nasty man, essentially? Like why are you, everything you want to do is morally corrupt. And of course it's an Orwell book. So it's sad that in the end he manages to corrupt the wife, you know? And the voice of reason is gone. Do you know, there's a really interesting thing about these Orwell books. They're all very different settings, but they're all very, very the same as well.
Okay.
You know, they are Orwellian, you know, and they have those same threads running through them. And
so the themes, yeah.
Yeah, and the way he has his characters, I always like his characters, because even though some of them are really not good people, you think that they're trying, and they always notice that the world around them isn't right. And that's sometimes how I feel in the world. So I empathize with them a little bit, you know.
Like the classic 1984, but this is a more historical or let's just say a journalist aspect rather than a dystopian, fantastic one. Okay.
I'll give you a couple of quotes, ideas about the way they treat the locals. So there's a guy, the locals are usually working like as their servants and things, you know, and they're complaining, you know, in the old days, you didn't have to pay them as much. And, you know, in the old days, you could just beat them. And nowadays, there's all these rules, you know, and it's unfair for us poor rich white people to have to follow rules and not beat our servants, you know. And they say, the only way I can even keep a servant nowadays is to pay their wages several months late. You know, it's the only way I can manage, you know, not thinking this poor chap's not getting his wages. You know, it's just the disregard, the lack of humanity.
Because obviously, if we're influenced by naturalism and that late 19th century novels like Emile Zola, that basically they show realism, the gritty side of realism, everything going down the drains, realism. And Orwell did say, actually, he said in Why I Write, he said, that he wanted to write enormous naturalistic novels with unhappy endings. And and that he said that the first book, that Burmese Days was rather that kind of book. So
it is, and it's one that, you know, Orwell wasn't happy with a lot of his early books, but he did accept this one. Some of them he wanted to take out of print. Like, you know, even we reviewed before, Keep the Aspidistra Flying, which I love, he thought it was garbage. You know? Didn't want to print it. And The Clergyman's Daughter, which I haven't read yet, you know, he actually stopped that being printed for a while. And then eventually he said, well, when he was dying, like, well, yeah, someone might make a bit of money off it, so I guess you can print it. But, you know, it's garbage. You know?
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah. Crazy. He was only ever, to be honest, I think he was really only happy with the two famous ones, with Animal Farm and 1984, to be honest. Okay. I mean, those are the only two that he was really happy, you know, thrilled about.
Wow, well, some of them were our worst critics, so I can
understand. Yeah, but there's a lot of this stuff. There's a part where they actually say, you know, they're complaining about the Indians and the natives, and they say, you know, one day we'll show them, one day we'll leave, and then what will they do without us? So I don't know, be free and not be controlled? I don't know, but they have this idea that they're there to improve, but the main character, Flory, he knows they're not, and he keeps saying to the doctor, Vereshwami, who he's friends with, he keeps saying, we're doing bad things here. I accept that, but if we would at least be honest about it, you know, we're telling this lie that we're here to like improve the lives of the natives, and we're not. We're just robbing them. And you know, he just can't deal with like the hypocrisy of the world around him. He's like, look, if we're going to do bad things, we can at least admit it. You know, that's kind of his. So he's not a hero, but he's trying to do something. You know.
Wow. Okay.
And there's a love story, because every book needs a little love story. And he meets this girl.
1984, yeah.
Yeah, he meets this girl. But, you know, Elizabeth, she's really... He likes her because she's basically the only young pretty girl there, so it's a pretty easy choice. And she's so cold with him. You know, she wants him to be this macho, manly guy that he's not. But he's friends with some of the locals. You know, he's friends with the Indian doctor, Vereshwami, and he gets a lot of stick from the other white people for being for not being racist, essentially, and for trying to be a good guy. And she finds this so repulsive that she falls out of love with him. She's like, I can't, you know, she won't even speak to him. And there's a horrible scene where he falls off a horse and he's hurt and he's bleeding and he's half mangled, fallen off this horse. And he calls out to her and she just ignores him. She doesn't care. Because she, you know, he's not who she thought he was. He's not a bad person, essentially. So she just snubs him and doesn't care if he lives or dies, almost, you know.
Wow. Okay.
So it's sad, actually, in parts. But your chap, you Po Kien, he actually tries to orchestrate a revolution so that he can then come in and stop his own revolution and look like a hero.
Oh, wow.
But the real hero is Flory. Flory is the only, he's not a hero, sorry, I said before, but he's the only good person, really, you know, in the book. Or he's the only person trying, you know. And it's, in part, it's a really addictive book. And it's a short book. It's only a couple hundred pages. And I read it very, very quickly. And it's an addictive one. But just the attitudes of the locals are bad. There's not a lot of a story, really. It's more just, you know, he's struggling with the world around him, with the empire. And then there's this little revolution. And that's more or less it, you know.
So it's a portrait of Burma in those times, as well as the British Empire. And I suppose he was very influenced by, you know, that, you know, British literature has a series of writers who are also travelers and critics of their own British Empire. I mean, you've got Joseph Conrad, who is Polish, but he wrote in English and really criticized particularly imperialism around the world, but in English. But more specifically, you've got Somerset Maugham, you know, the great short story writer. I loved his work when I was a teen, writing these little short stories that always portrayed kind of white privileged classes and how they're kind of abusing the natives and how out of contact they are, how disconnected they are with them, but also with themselves, and how the British Empire is just, and it's just stagnant. You know, at that point, this was written in the 30s, and Somerset Maugham is also writing in the 2030s. It just becomes very stagnant, this British Empire. It's time to let it go. You get this feeling before the Second World War. I love authors were trying to say this.
Yeah, and from doing the Orwell classes, I mean, the interesting thing about Orwell is he was against, I don't know if he was against the empire per se, but he definitely knew that like change was needed, you know. Up until the Second World War started, and then he became, you know, he kept saying we got to stop the war effort, like this is, you know, he was really, really against it, he was really anti-war, and then as soon as the war started, he just flipped and became like a patriot and wanted to help, you know. But I suppose if you think that you're a that can happen if you feel that you're at risk, like, you know, then you might become a patriot, I guess. I don't know.
Interesting.
But there's a chap I love called Verrill, and he's a military officer, and he just goes around on the nicest horses and, you know, orders everyone around. And he's right. Elizabeth eventually falls in love with him instead of poor Flory, because Flory's not, you know, the only time she really cares about Flory is when he takes her hunting. And it's a horrible scene where they're just killing these poor animals, you know, and it's a lot of the stuff doesn't hold up today, actually. But the guy Verrill, he's the sort of chap who just, he's sitting reading his newspaper, you know, and you come over to him and you ask him something, and he says, things like, you know, my good chap, when someone gives me lip, I kick their bottom. Do you want your bottom kicked? Okay, if not, you know, go away and I'll go back to my newspaper. You know, there's a lot of this kind of like posh British stuff, which I always find humorous. That's one of my favorite, you know, forms of humor. But it's good. And then I moved on and I read this one. Have you heard of this one? Coming Up for Air.
I haven't heard that one. So what's that about? Is that also by Orwell?
It's another Orwell one. I think it's less than 200 pages. Like, these are short books by Orwell. You know, they're not. This isn't Dickens. But you know what? What's funny? You know the trick, right? The Anna Karenina trick of inserting a 700-page farming manual.
It's a classic.
Well, Orwell makes a mistake of doing that trick in a book that's less than 200 pages long. He introduces 50 pages about fishing. And that's not ideal. You know, if you've got 800 pages to play with, you can do that. You can do the Dostoevsky method and put a 100-page, you know, religious narrative or whatever. But if you've only got like 180 pages, you can't be using 50 of them about fishing.
Oh, no. He was obviously too inspired and wanted to do the same thing. Oh,
he was.
And the fishing manual.
This one is no plot, actually. But again, it's a microcosm. It's a picture of someone's life.
Yeah.
And he's unhappy with the world around him. And it has the fear of the coming war. You know, it's typical, you know, you get it in 1984 and everything, but it's always this fear of the society and the war that's coming and this kind of thing. The chap, he fought in World War One, but he was in a team that did nothing. They sent him to a beach somewhere and forgot about him. And he's just there by himself with this one disgruntled old soldier that he doesn't talk to. And he just reads books and thinks like, oh, this war's not so bad. Like, you know, I'm not doing anything. Like, they just sent him to an outpost in a team that didn't, he says, this team doesn't even exist. Like, they've put me in a regiment that doesn't exist. I'm getting paid and I'm just chilling, you know? Okay. But he's afraid of World War II and he's afraid of Hitler and he's afraid of Stalin and all this kind of stuff, you know? And he has a friend who's a literary sort of chap, and he sits around, you know, pipe and slippers kind of chap, and he keeps saying, oh, there's nothing new under the sun. Hitler, Stalin, now they're just copying the Greeks and the Romans, and you can't get any conversation out of him that doesn't go back to the Greeks and the Romans. But because of that, despite all of his intelligence, he doesn't see the actual upcoming threat, and that's what's curious. But this poor chap, George, all he does, he's not a nice, all these Orwell guys, they're not nice chaps. The only redeeming thing is that I empathize with them because they see something wrong in the world, you know?
Yes, all right. But so they all hold that in common, right?
They all have it, yeah. Okay. But this guy's not likable. I mean, he's cheating on his wife. He's doing all this kind of stuff. He wants to kill his wife at one point, actually. He says, I don't know why I married her. And for the first few years, I seriously thought about killing her. But then afterwards, I just behold her. He doesn't talk to her enough to really get to know her. So he's always curious, like, what are these women doing? Like, I just don't get them, you know? And it's really weird, you know? He went from hating her to just being curious about her. But he always says, like, oh, she's not intelligent, she lost her looks, whatever else, you know? And her friends go to these talks, and he says, oh, they don't understand a word of the talks. They're just, you know, going because they think they're supposed to or whatever. He's very, very negative on her. And then he disappears for a few days to you know, he wants to go fishing. All he ever wants to do is go fishing. But the sad part is he never goes fishing.
All right. Okay, so that's the tragedy.
Yeah, he just wants to, but he never has the time. He went fishing when he was 15. He's never been since. And, you know, he just really wants to go fishing again. And everyone says, oh, grown man fishing, that's such a stupid idea, you know.
So is that what it's about, basically? So it talks about fishing the whole time in an abstract sense, but nothing ever happens. It's just him dreaming about what was more, maybe or less, a more idyllic time.
And he goes away for a few days and he goes back to see the town he grew up in. Because he describes, there's a big fishing narrative and there's another big narrative where he talks about his childhood days. And, you know, he grew up and, you know, very traditional. His dad owned a little shop and the profits were getting worse and worse. But his dad kept saying, well, things will look up presently. And he never realized, oh no, the big shop down the street is going to put us out of business. You know, he just stuck with his old world. You know, I've ran this little shop for 50 years and it's always been here and we'll keep doing it. But it just gets less and less and less profitable as time goes on. It was a shop that sold like just bird seed and that was it. Like, I don't know, that's a very profitable business. But, you know, and then the mum, you know, she says, you know, she never leaves the house. There's parts of the house she's not even been in. You know, she's just like, I'm in the kitchen all day, I'm cooking, and that's literally it. And he thinks, you know, but I had it wasn't so bad those days. And he looks at the world around him now and it's all different. And so he goes back to the town of his youth. And of course, it's all changed. It's become a modern city. There's factories and there's workers and it's all different. And he's sad because all he wants to do is recapture something. And he goes and he can't. And he doesn't even tell his wife where he's going. He lies and says he's going somewhere else. So she thinks he's having an affair. And he's just kind of like, well, you know, she catches me, whatever. Like sometimes she's always suspicious that I'm having an affair. Sometimes she's right, sometimes she's wrong, you know. And he doesn't really seem to mind. But it's
all right, but it doesn't sound as captivating of a book as
in a way it's not. But there's mundane details that really let you, Orwell's good at letting you see how depressing the society is, you know. And he talks about just their dingy little houses and, you know, their salaries and everything. And everyone's the same. A row of houses where essentially every person in it's just the same, you know. And then the sad thing is none of them even own the houses because there was some kind of scam where they ended up buying their own houses on like a really weird loan thing. So essentially they're paying them off and paying them off, but they never own them, you know?
So would you, do you see a connection between Dickens and Orwell's?
Yeah, I think that there are some connections. Obviously it's a different type of society and Orwell isn't, you know, he doesn't do those like almost comically over the top characters that Dickens does, but you see the depression in the society and you know, there is that similarity, I think. Yeah.
Wow, okay.
Orwell, I also actually read some Orwell essays, and one was in defense of Dickens, because around that time, Orwell helped repopularize Dickens. Around that time, Dickens was seen as a bit of a silly author, actually, and Orwell wrote this massive essay in praise of how good Dickens really is and actually helped like repopularize him.
Well, so there you go. So obviously he did find... You know, he obviously was inspired by Dickens, and as you say, he does mention naturalist novels. So, what there was other novels that came after Dickens, turning realism, going one step further, going really into detail. But yeah,
but the honest answer is almost nothing happens in this book. You know, if I'm being really honest, they talk a lot about fishing, and he goes back to the town. That's the only real plot point, and you know, nothing even happens when he does go back to the town. He just gets drunk a lot. You know, his wife sits around reading Hilda's Home Companion and sort of thinking, you know, here's how to do things around the house, and he looks down on her for it. But he never attempts to help her either. You know, he always says, well, she's got no hobbies, she's got no interests, that's her problem. But he doesn't try to help her. He just kind of looks at her like a curiosity. You know, he doesn't try to make any connection with his wife, which is really strange.
Okay. Interesting. But so the fishing is always like a metaphor for something idyllic, something that is different, something that is not the present. Oh, yeah, Stalin, Hitler just around the corner. He tries to get away. So it's escapism.
Yeah. And he has kids that he has no interest in either. He's just like, these kids, you know, whatever. Right. Like he doesn't care. You know, he's just not interested at all.
It's interesting to read the book because it was published in June 1939. So it'd be interesting to read it as a, like, what did people think? Feel just before the war ends, or escalating, and what escapism to have,
and then of course the line coming up for air appears, and the idea is that he just feels so stuffy and so bogged down in this world that isn't right, and he wants to come up for air, and he says, but there isn't any air, and he's like, we are in the dystopia, basically. That's what he's saying, you know. He's like, I want to come up for air, but there isn't any. We're living in a garbage place, you know. And it hit me as like, yeah, that is also true, you know. So. And he wants to escape, though. So I'll read a quote here. He says, he's talking about all these nosy Parkers and everyone's, you know, not minding their own business. And he says, the Home Secretary, Scotland Yard, the Temperance League, the Bank of England, Hitler, Stalin on a tandem bicycle, a bench of bishops, Mussolini, the Pope, they're all after me. He feels that the whole society, the whole world is chasing him. There's a chap who thinks he's going to escape. There's a chap who thinks he won't be streamlined, you know, but he wants to escape. And he just feels that the whole world is just always crowding in on him and he can't escape, you know? Wow.
It's a powerful reading.
Yeah, but I massively recommend Orwell to anyone, to be honest. He's brilliant. And the short books, they're very accessible. I recommend 1984 to someone on an almost daily basis. Because anytime someone says anything about modern life, I'm like, have you read 1984, though?
So it's very, it's also like he always talks about relevant themes that, especially the other ones that are not 1984 coming up for air or Burmese Days, which are maybe more historical now, but they're all related to the fact that society needs to change. That he's always trying to say, look, this is not working society. I'm showing you the present. I'm showing you what could happen in the future as a metaphor. I'm showing you with like a fairy tale, like with Animal Farm. He's always criticizing and making sure that people are not blinded, right? So he's trying to basically lead the people into what he thinks is a more conscious and society that criticizes the bad things rather than just accepts it.
Yes, he is. And I'll be honest, I was really, really excited to find that he loved Dickens, but he wrote an article about someone else. He wrote in defense of P.G. Wodehouse. Did you know that?
Oh my God.
Yeah.
No, I did not know that.
He was also a fan of and defender of Wodehouse. I don't remember the details of the article, but I think Wodehouse was so politically naive that he, you know, and at one point, like he was on Nazi radio because I think he just didn't really understand, you know, and they say go ahead.
Yeah, he was a nat. He was so Wodehouse, as we talked about him, I'm a big fan of P.G. Wodehouse. He was a comic novelist. He was very popular around the 20s, and just like Fitzgerald, afterwards he'd be considered we're in depression now. Why are you still writing about the 20s? So just like Fitzgerald, he also lost some popularity. People were against him, and he thought he was stuck in that jazz age. But the reason why he was in Nazi radio is because he lived in France. And basically, the Nazis captured the area around him, and he had to it was kind of either go to a concentration camp. I'm not sure if it was quite as severe as that, but it was more or less, PG, either go to a concentration camp or just go on the radio for us and make some comedy, but on Nazi radio. And yes, I think you're right. PG Wodehouse was not interested in politics. Don't think he was a Nazi, though. I don't think it's anything.
No, it's not made clear. The point that Orwell makes is that he was so naive that he just didn't really know what he was doing. You know, he says P.G. Wodehouse literally lives in that 20s world that he writes about. Like he doesn't know anything else. Yeah. You know.
Oh, but why does he? I'm very curious. So what does he like about P.G. Wodehouse? Because I love P.G. Wodehouse, but don't we see the connection between Orwell?
It's not even that there's a connection. I think he just liked the books, and he wanted to defend him because I guess P.G. Wodehouse was getting a bad rap. For a while, people were saying, you know, well, he, you know, essentially did Nazi propaganda radio, so that's enough of a reason to get a bad rap, I guess, you know. And Orwell was kind of saying, yeah, but he didn't know what he was doing, you know. He is Worcester. He is, you know, he's living in a dream world. You got to give him a buy ball on this one, you know. And they said, like, the world he was writing about, because Wodehouse lived in America for a long time as well. And they said, look, the England that he was writing about didn't exist, but he didn't know that because he wasn't there. So he thought England was still like this. And the guy's just a dreamer, basically. You gotta let him go on this one. You know?
So while Orwell was writing about England in the 30s and his empires, Wodehouse was still living in the jazz age.
Depression. And I think the main crux of the argument is, you know, Wodehouse is just so naive that he just doesn't realize that the world is changing around him, and he thinks he is still living in the jazz age. You know?
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. Matt, we're going to get to your book in a second, but first, we have a two-minute clip sent in from a fan.
Oh, wow.
Hey, PJ and Dean, it's Casey from Casey's Bookshelf over on Instagram. I wanted to say happy anniversary and congratulations on a fantastic year of sharing your love of so many great books. I wish you both many, many more years of great reads and great conversations. I love the podcast, and I have a book I want to share with you. I know you guys love the classics, so I wanted to share something a little more contemporary that may be a little outside of your wheelhouse, and that's Quan Berry's We Write Upon Sticks. The book's funny, fast-paced, and a good time from start to finish. The story takes place in Danvers, Massachusetts, which is where the Salem witch trials began in 1692. Fast forward nearly 300 years later, and we're in 1989, focusing on a local high school women's field hockey team who, despite a lot of heart and a lot of effort, just can't seem to win a game. That is until the summer before their senior year, the team's goalie decides to take matters into her own hands and calls upon some dark forces to help them out. And soon, one by one, the rest of the team joins in. It's honestly a really fun take on a subject matter that's been pretty deeply explored. The book's full of 80s iconography from movies to big hair, and it makes for a really, really fun read. And even though it's technically about a sports team, it never feels like a sports book. It's just a really interesting take on the witch trials. If you don't know, Quan Berry is an award-winning American poet. She grew up in the area the book is set in and even played for her local field hockey team. So she does a really great job of describing the game and the positions for those of us who may not be super familiar with the sport, and does so in a very approachable and entertaining way that really feels like it adds to and is part of the story, and it never feels like you're reading like a rule book. I also happen to be pretty big on audiobooks, so if y'all or any of your listeners are into them too, this is a really great audiobook to check out. It's narrated by Isabel Keating, who is a spectacular voice actress who does an amazing job with this story. I highly recommend it. If y'all happen to check it out, make sure to stop by my page and let me know what you think. Again, happy anniversary and congratulations. Bye!
There we go. That was from Casey's Bookshelf on Instagram.
Oh, that's really lovely of you. Thanks for your lovely message. And I certainly want to check out that book. Well, that sounds just up my street, actually, Quan Berry. Quan Berry's We Ride Upon Sticks. Now, I think, come on, like, you know, I saw you nodding your head. 80s, especially when she got to the 80s, the big
hair. Yes. Like, so I do. We do love an 80s aesthetic. Well, I do especially. It's my whole jam.
And I love the witches, especially. I have a witch in my novel as well. So, I mean, that just sounds just up my street. We ride upon sticks. Nice.
A strange thing happened there, though, that I didn't know if you could hear the clip or not. So for 2 minutes, I was just looking like, I don't know if you can hear this. Is he sitting in silence for 2 minutes? I don't know what's happening.
Oh, okay. Well, it was just. I'm thank very much for that lovely message. Really appreciate that. And it's nice to hear from a fan. So anyone wants to say anything out,
anyone can send it booksboys@hotmail.com. send us a 2 minute clip, tell us what you've been reading, and you know, we'll play it on the radio.
Indeed.
EJ, wow. What have you been reading?
So then I've been reading one of my favorite authors, Haruki Murakami, who you know yourself. What I talk about when I talk about running, have you ever heard of this book before?
I've read some Murakami that you've recommended before, but I have not heard of this one. No, I've not read it.
So this one is essentially a memoir talking about sports. It could be considered a sport book, although I think it's more, for me, it's more of a philosophical treatise on running, per se. So what is it about? It's about Haruki Murakami is a Japanese novelist. His most famous novel is Norwegian Woods, which turned into a movie as well. He's famous for these surreal, some would say postmodern, some would say pop fiction novels. But I love him because it's always about these lonely characters who are essentially lost, and sounds a bit like a Norwegian character, except it's always very surreal what's happening to them. So talking cats and, you know, parallel universes and all kinds of things. But what I talk about when I talk about running is essentially about his experience with jogging and running, which he's been doing since 1982. And he did this because Haruki Murakami was initially a jazz bar owner, going late to bed and just writing in the wee hours of the dawn. And his health was basically going down the drains, as you can imagine. So he decided to both become a full-time novelist, which is his third novel, A Wild Sheep's Chase. And at the same time, he realized he could only do this if he physically got into shape. So he started jogging. So he started a jogging routine simultaneously while he started his quite strict novelist routine. And Haruki Murakami has always had a very strict routine. He wakes up at 4 a.m., starts writing for about 6 hours straight. Then he jogs and he swims, goes early to bed. For me, that's very Japanese, actually. So, and he talks about just, well, what makes him a successful runner, but also what makes him a successful novelist in the sense that this routine works for him. So it's essentially, it's very similar to, the concept similar to Stephen King's on writing. So it's a novelist talking about novel writing, but he's talking about running at the same time and how it helps him. And it's very readable, as is all Murakami's books. It's very engaging. It just talks about what he feels like when he's running and what sensations go in his head. What's the philosophy of running? Why do joggers run? And I really wanted to read this one because I've been getting back into running. I've always enjoyed jogging and running. And essentially, I just want to tell a brief part of it was is he talks about running, and people ask him what he thinks about when he's running, and he says he doesn't think about anything. If he's feeling good, he thinks a bit about feeling good. If he feels cold, he thinks about the cold a bit. He feels
so he's not using it to philosophize or anything like that. He's just in the moment.
Exactly, he's in the moment. What he does, he runs because he wants to create a void inside of him. First of all, he runs because it's what his body naturally wants. And second of all, he thinks the benefit of running for a novice is not to get inspired. He says he doesn't particularly get inspired or have deep philosophical thoughts, but it's actually to empty the mind. And that's the way I feel, honestly, when I run. I feel I'm not particularly thinking about anything at all. I'm just kind of letting all the head stuff go. It's particularly if I had a very head brainy sort of day, using my head a lot, kind of letting it go. Because especially if you want to be creative and you put too much into your head, I find nothing's going to come out. It's all jammed. It's all energy stuck. And basically by running, you just kind of, I imagine always you're running and you're slowly, throwing a bit of that unnecessary thoughts away, just kind of throwing away and making your head empty again. So that when you sit back down again, you're ready for some new ideas to come in. And this novel is about that. And about the about what it feels like for him to be running and then writing, and he talks about also, and there's an interesting chapter here about what are the necessary qualities to become not a successful novelist, but just a novelist as a person who writes on a consistent basis. And let me just get it for you now, Dean. Hold on a second. This one now. Excuse me. Oh, yeah. So this is a very interesting part about the discipline of novel writing. So I'm just quoting. In every interview, I'm asked, what's the most important quality a novelist has to have? It's pretty obvious. Talent. No matter how much enthusiasm and effort you put into writing, if you totally lack literary talent, you can forget about being a novelist. This is more of a prerequisite than a necessary quality. If you don't have any fuel, even the best car won't run. The problem with talent, though, is that in most cases, the person involved can't control its amount or quality. You might find the amount isn't enough and you want to increase it, or you might try to be frugal to make it last longer. But in neither case do things work out that easily. Talent has a mind of its own and wells up when it wants to, and once it dries up, that's it. If I'm asked what the next most important quality is for a novice, that's easy too. Focus. And then he talks about, in this part, just to summarize, he talks about that focus is absolutely necessary, but you're only able to have focus if you don't have pain. And the problem is he talks that if novelists, they sit too long, they're going to develop a type of pain or discomfort, and that actually will distract you. It won't allow you to have the second quality. Yes, and the next quality he talks about, the third, is endurance. Being able to sit down 3 or 4 hours and give it all your attention, similar to focus, but actually being able to just stand that, because he talks about sometimes it being painful. He also mentions, for example, the mystery writer Raymond Chandler. Raymond Chandler actually sat down every day for a few hours, even if nothing came up, just because it became a routine. So essentially, this is successful habits to acquire for novelists. So he talks about that you don't need to have talent you need to have a certain amount of talent as a novelist. But it's not enough, to be honest, because if you don't have talent, if you have talent but no focus and endurance, it's just wasted. It's just going to be wasted. But if you have little talent, that's still okay, as long as you've got a hell of focus and endurance and you start practicing. So it talks about writing down and practicing every day. It should be a routine.
Mm-hmm. But PJ, I want to ask you a question, because you mentioned this idea of talent. There's a certain pot of talent and it will eventually run out. I mean, we're creative types. We both do artistic kinds of things. I paint, you make music and poetry and everything. Do you feel that, like, at some point that's it? Like, do you think that you're going to run out of talent? Like, do you agree with that sentiment?
No, I don't think so. I don't think we're going to necessarily run out in talent. But he says it could happen. And it has happened to some novelists where they just didn't write again, and you're kind of left wondering. Mm-hmm. I can't really imagine that, but it has happened to a few. I find it especially with artists that start off very, very young, and they really produce some massively great novels at a young age. But then they run out of few, or just the stuff they write later is not as good. It doesn't seem to have the same appeal. And but he talks about that in the novel. So I'm just summarizing some briefly. He talks about these young novelists especially that do that, but because they don't have a routine, they kind of get lazy. They get slack. And he essentially talks about the parallel. He's always talking about the parallel between muscle building, especially in running, and a novelist, and he compares it to, so when you got to jog, do a marathon, then you got to have endurance, you got to have focus, and he talks about, leaves out the talent, you see, he says jogging is good to practice the next two things, because talent is a prerequisite, but it's not enough, and especially if you got little talent, he says himself he has little talent, he doesn't consider himself he talks about there are Dickens and Shakespeare's in life, but there's not. Most novelists need to really work on their endurance and focus.
Yeah.
And I do see that a lot, where you have them for a while being stellar in their production, but then they lose momentum, I suppose. Even Murakami, I love the man, but I don't feel that he's quite, the last few books I've read from him, the more recent ones, I don't feel are quite as powerful.
Which is the one that I've read. Kafka on the Shore, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Kafka on the Shore. I love that one, actually.
It's good, but his writing style is a little unusual for me. I don't know. I think so.
Did you read Hardboiled Wonderland? Did you also read that?
Not yet, no.
That one is absolutely my favorite novel, and that's quite an early novel. Yeah, but he talks about, honestly, I can see Murakami. I've read his first three novels, for example. I've read almost all of his novels, but the first two novels he wrote it at, sporadically, while he was working in jazz bar at 4 a.m., 5 a.m., before going to sleep. And then when he changed his routine, he completely changed his routine, and he got up at 4 a.m. and started writing. Got up, he didn't go to bed. So it's like the difference between waking up and writing is very different to going just before sleep.
Isn't this a similar routine that you followed when you were writing? Like, you were getting up really early and working and before doing your morning exercises and things, you know?
Exactly, yeah. So I also have follow a similar routine. I also tried out midday writing. It also worked for me for a while. But the thing is, I always usually, almost always write after I sleep. After a big sleep, nighttime. But it was my first novel, actually. I wasn't waking up early. It was my first novel I was writing after having a siesta at 1 p.m. Mm-hmm. And then
SPJ is in Gran Canaria, so he's allowed to have a siesta. He's in Spanish land.
To have a siesta. And then the dojo of his writing, so it's an ideal life. Yes, I'm very privileged. But I suppose Murakami living in Tokyo, it's not really a thing you do there. So I can completely get it that he wakes up early in the morning. It also works. For me, it's a different writing style. But I suggest if you're becoming a writer, and especially in the discipline, this is a great kind of novelist discipline book, or at least recommendation. And I completely agree with physical activity, doing that before writing. But before writing, really kind of tire yourself out in some sense. He talks about pushing himself. He's a bit insane, Murakami. And I can totally see that with his routine. He's always pushing himself. He actually says, his massage therapist says, you should, what are you doing? You should be cramped up to the eyeballs. I can't believe you've got so much endurance. So he actually does have a lot of endurance. So I'm really enjoying this book. Read it. It's a memoir. He also talks about his life, and Murakami is very reclusive. So it's actually nice to hear a bit about his life. Mm. And it's just a great read, especially if you're a Murakami fan, or if you're a jogging fan, or if you're into philosophy. This is more than anything, is this philosophy. Or if you're an aspiring novelist or novice trying to get some successful novelist habits. Heinrich.
There we go. Like yourself. There we go. Brilliant. By the way, speaking of you being in Spain, so I was in Madrid this month, and I send you copious books that I bought. I packed my little rucksack, because I only went for a few days, and I only brought a change of clothes. And that little rucksack was packed with a dozen Spanish books, very heavy, but I didn't think I was going to get them through the airport.
The amusing thing is, I talked to you just before you left and wrote to you like a big list, a big shopping list, basically. I said, Dean, look, you're going to Spain, you gotta get these novels and these authors.
I got most of them, but I didn't think I would.
You know, you said to them, look, Vijay, I can only buy 2 books. And then the next day, you send me of all these books plus more from the same authors. So I'm glad you take my, recommendations so seriously that you even buy more books.
But PJ, I had no room in my suitcase for the Spanish ham.
So how did you get them back to Ireland? Did you sneak them through the black market or something?
Yeah, because I only brought hand luggage and I just had this little rucksack full of books bulging from all the seams,
I used to do the same though. Essentially, actually still do the same. I also put them into pockets, jacket pockets, like stuff them anywhere when we stuff these books, and I had always try to make it look light.
I had to wear 3 layers in the airport because I didn't have any room in my bag for my jumper or my coat.
That's what I did. I used to, I've tried to get rid of that habit because I love books. But I just thought, I can't, because it was getting insane. Every time I traveled, I just had 3 coats full of books, and it's all nonsense, really, isn't it?
It's ridiculous. Wow. Did I tell you I'm going back to Madrid in 4 weeks?
Yeah, you told me that.
Yeah, so I guess I'm going to do it all over again. This time I need to leave room for the ham.
And did you love the Museo del Prado?
Yes, I loved the Prado Museum. So I'm going to try to do another one when I go back. And guys, if you want to see my trip around Madrid on our Instagram, there's photos of all the bookshops I visited. I did a little hunt of all the bookshops in Madrid, including the Benito Pérez Galdós bookshop.
Oh my God!
Your chap, your friend.
Indeed, basically the Dickens of Spain, Benito Pérez Galdós. So, Raz, if you're in Madrid, check out the bookshop. In case you're wondering, we're not actually sponsored by the Madrid Tourism Board, although I think after this great sellout, they should give us a few thousand quid.
Guys, come on! We're not sponsored by them, but you know who we are sponsored by this month? It's the Dickens Office of Circumlocution. So this is the office for not getting it done. So if there's ever something that you don't want to get done, but you want to go through a very lengthy bureaucratic process of form filling and fee paying and stamping and bringing it to one clerk, to another clerk, to another clerk, only for several years later to eventually give up because it's bankrupted you and you've not achieved anything, then the Office of Circumlocution, guys, how not to get it done.
An investment. Do it, guys.
We're going to take a 30-second break and play an ad from a podcast called The Paranoid Strain, friends of ours, and we'll be back in a second.
Hi, I'm Fearful Jesuit, host of The Paranoid Strain, a show that explains conspiracy theories to normal people. Every episode is carefully researched, fully scripted, and incorporates interviews, audio clips, original music, and a bunch of nonsense to explain the history, impact, and bizarre beliefs related to one conspiracy topic at a time. We're doing an extensive series on secret societies, the Knights Templar, the Freemasons, the Illuminati, and we'd love to have you along for the ride. New episodes drop every 2 weeks.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Weeks, wherever you get your podcasts.